There is potential for certain activities associated with large-scale mining to have adverse effects on the productivity and sustainability of the salmon fishery, but the agency has made no judgments about the use of its regulatory authority under the Clean Water Act.
The EPA releases a draft document on large-scale mines in Bristol Bay. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 18th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a curious breakup on the Kuskokwim.
I have never seen anything like that where in a matter of 5 hours, the ice down here from Bethel to Neposkiak just went from a whitish color to brown.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska, providing quality health plans to companies and individuals in Alaska for over 60 years. More at primera.com. Primera Blue Cross Blue Shield of Alaska. We know the territory.
The Environmental Protection Agency has released a draft document intended to inform their decision-making process in regards to large mining projects in the Bristol Bay region. KDLG's Dave Benninger has the story.
EPA's Region 10 Director Dennis McLaren held a press conference Friday to announce the release of the draft Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment.
I want to be very clear that today's release is not a regulatory decision.
And that set the tone of McLaren's statements Friday as he stressed repeatedly that this assessment is not intended as a regulatory position. Instead, it was created as a way to inform the decision makers in response to requests for the EPA to use its 404C veto authority to stop the proposed Pebble Mine. McLaren said that the assessment makes no such recommendation. However, the document is intended to serve the EPA going forward.
Will help to inform future decision-making, and we believe it will be of use not just to EPA, but to other federal, state, and local governments that are engaged in reviewing activities up in the watershed.
The watershed assessment runs to several hundred pages and focuses on the economic and cultural benefits of the natural resources in the region.
The assessment did find that Bristol Bay's wild salmon fishery produces almost half of the world's sockeye salmon, and these salmon resources and other ecological resources in those two watersheds is valued at about $480 billion annually.
Moreover, the assessment takes into account what impact potential mining could have on those resources.
The report concludes that there is potential for certain activities associated with large-scale mining to have adverse effects on the productivity and sustainability of the salmon fishery. But the agency has made no judgments about the use of its regulatory authority under the Clean Water Act.
McLaren says the report was not focused on any single mining project, but because no plans by any of the potential mines have been submitted by the companies, the EPA chose to use a hypothetical scenario, taking into account both normal operations and possible failures.
But it is focused on a hypothetical mining scenario that was developed using our knowledge of publicly available documents about potential for mining activity in the watershed.
Many of the groups waiting for the assessment issued statements soon after the release. Senator Mark Begich from Alaska reaffirmed his opposition to any preemptive decision on Pebble Mine. Begich says the mining companies deserve the chance to let their development plans, once submitted, stand on their own merits. Pebble Partnership CEO John Shively called the assessment rushed. Others have applauded the EPA's work. Trout Unlimited and other groups that represent sport and commercial fishing interests in Bristol Bay once again called on the agency to use its 404C veto authority to stop development of Pebble and other mines. Bristol Bay Native Corporation CEO Jason Matrokin agreed and said he hopes the EPA continues their balanced approach as they assemble the final version.
Once a final version of the watershed assessment is out, we do believe that the information would support action by the EPA. We think that action is warranted. We think that action is appropriate, but it needs to include balanced, science-based information.
It's unlikely the draft assessment will affect policy decisions anytime soon. McLaren says the draft is being released now in order to gather public comment and scientific peer review.
This is the beginning beginning of a process that will include extensive public comment and rigorous independent review. This is still a draft assessment, and we want to get the science right.
The final version isn't expected until the fall. Public comment will be taken from now until July 23rd, and public meetings are being scheduled throughout Alaska in the months ahead. The EPA has made the document and all the appendices available to the public on their website, epa.gov/region10/Bristol Bay. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Pictures of the Pebble Mine area are at our website, alaskapublic.org. Representative Don Young voted to increase Pentagon spending today. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the defense authorization is facing a veto from the president.
The budget-cutting hysteria that overtook Washington last summer is now gone. The bill that passed the House with bipartisan support comes in at $643 billion. That's $8 billion higher than the president and House Republicans agreed to last year. Included is money for a new missile defense shield on the East Coast. Fort Greely, which houses some of the nation's current missile defense system, is slated to receive about $200 million. Any spending, though, faces an uphill battle. Senate Democrats will likely move a smaller bill, one that looks like the president's. If it sounds like politics, it is. The bill is loaded with highly charged amendments, like reaffirming indefinite detention. And those political amendments could ultimately seal the bill's fate and leave it as nothing more than a political show. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
The state-regulated company that collects garbage in Juneau will start offering curbside recycling next month. Arrow Refuge plans to pick up commingled materials, including paper, cardboard, metal cans, and plastics, but not glass. Customers can opt into the service for $3.11 a month. Many Juneau residents have long clamored for curbside recycling, but not everyone is convinced that Arrow service is right for the community. As part of our statewide series on recycling, KTOO's Casey Kelly has more.
If you want to recycle in Juneau right now, you have to go to the recycling center at the landfill. Every day, about 1,300 cars pass through the facility as residents separate their recyclables and ditch them in giant dumpsters. Middle school teacher Jay Watts says it's part of his weekly routine.
I bring mostly aluminum, some glass bottles, cardboard, paper, tin cans.
Watts says he would prefer the convenience of curbside recycling and plans to take a look at Arrow Refuse's new service as soon as it's available. He thinks other Juneau residents will do the same.
I've heard that there's less than 10% of the people in Juneau that recycle, so we could raise that percentage.
Like many Alaska communities, Juneau has limited landfill space. The current facility is likely to reach capacity in 23 years if residents continue to dump trash in it at the present rate. Arrow Refuse owns the state certificate to provide garbage collection in the capital city. The company has a contract with landfill operator Waste Management that covers its tipping fee, or the amount it pays to dispose of trash at the dump. Arrow General Manager Jeff Riley says extending the life of the landfill is the biggest reason the company is offering curbside recycling.
Not until that landfill was full would people completely appreciate how much the cost would increase to getting rid of their garbage.
Arrow will still take recyclables to the facility at the landfill, but the materials won't be separated as they are now. Instead, they'll be baled together and shipped to the lower 48, where they'll be sorted and sold on the recyclables market. Juneau resident and longtime recycling advocate Nancy Waterman is concerned the plan won't pencil out. Right now, she says separated materials can be worth more than twice as much as commingled, and the difference is growing.
Many Juneau people have been working diligently to get to the point of being able to have a curbside pickup system. But I'm still wondering whether co-mingled, baled material is the right way to ship our material back south.
The city and borough of Juneau is currently in negotiations with Waste Management to expand the separated recycling center at the landfill to make it easier for customers to recycle more materials. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, worrying about climate change in Selawik.
Whatever happened in our world is going to happen. And if Selawik sinks under, and we're going to do it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
Although dozens of people were evacuated, breakup on the lower Kuskokwim River was a lot less eventful than what experts had expected. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has more.
While the middle Kuskokwim River was breaking up last week, snow machiners were traveling on the ice highway just 100 miles downriver. Near Bethel, the ice looked white and flat. It measured 50 inches thick in some places. Temperatures were freezing every night and didn't get much warmer in the day. So with open water upriver and thick ice downriver, many experienced river watchers predicted flooding. Three lower villages decided to evacuate over 100 elderly and chronic care patients as precautionary measures. The village of Kuithluk did experience flooding, but all other communities just saw high water.
It's about the best scenario that we could have hoped for.
Ben Bach is a National Weather Service hydrologist who studied the breakup over the past week.
I have never seen anything like that where in a matter of 5 hours, the ice down here from Bethel to Neposkiak just went from a whitish color to brown.
Bach, who has followed the Kuskokwim breakup for several years, wasn't the only one scratching his head. 30-year search and rescue leader Peter Achak said in a Chupik interview that he, too, hadn't seen that kind of quick change before from white ice to dark. He said it looked like the water was boiling from underneath the ice. According to a post on the Bethel Search and Rescue's website, quote, somehow the thick ice became rubber-like and soft despite the cold winter and spring weather, which made people believe Bethel might have a bad breakup. So what really happened?
We think that the open water upriver had time to be exposed to sunlight and warmer temperatures, and that warmer water temperatures might have helped rot the ice from underneath.
Fox says the river was warmer than the cold, snowy weather people experienced above the ice. So instead of seeing the ice deteriorate over a week, like a traditional breakup, it took only a few hours. As of Thursday, high water was receding and all evacuees had returned to their homes. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
From an ice standpoint, the lower Kuskokwim breakup may have been quick, but in the eyes of residents along the river, it was a long time coming. In Bethel, dozens of people even gathered together for a riverside party. KYUK's Mark Earhart has more.
These are sounds that many in the Waikei Delta haven't heard for a while. This past winter was a tough one on the lower Kuskokwim. This January in Bethel was even the coldest on record. But now all the ice and snow are gone, and many have gathered by the river to celebrate.
Man, it brings joy. It's the sign of warmth, plus just being by the water just makes everything better.
That's Art Freitas. He's got his back to the river, looking at a line of people that stretches a few football fields long.
After this hard winter, it's good to see warmth.
All these people are here for the Breakup Bash. The event, thrown by the Bethel Community Services Foundation, features plenty of free hot dogs and punch and live music. Brandon Wipa, who had just finished his second hot dog, says he too is looking forward to what the summer brings.
Well, my daughter's coming in from Hawaii. She's going to be staying with me for the summer, so we're definitely going to go on the river, you know, go do some fishing, do some fish camping.
It seems many have similar ideas. People walk and talk with hot dogs. Some are in shorts and some are in t-shirts. In Bethel, I'm Mark Earhart.
Commander Ward Sandlin took over as commanding officer of Air Station Sitka on Wednesday. The top job changes every 2 years. Sandlin replaces Commander Doug Cameron. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
They gathered in the cavernous hangar at Air Station Sitka in front of a floor-to-ceiling American flag.
Present. Arms.
Coast Guard officers in their formal uniforms family members holding flowers, members of the community. This was a celebration of the change of command, a military ceremony full of pomp and circumstance, but also reflection.
Like most that have served here, I have no doubt that when my Coast Guard career ends, this will be the tour that I remember the most.
Commander Doug Cameron took command in late June of 2010. It was just 1 week later that a helicopter crashed off the coast of Washington, claiming the lives of three people from Air Station Sitka.
Together as a community and as an air station, somehow we managed to get through the light nightmare of losing three of our own. I know the day will never come that I don't think of Sean, Brent, and Adam. And I know I'm not alone. I will miss each and every one of you. I take comfort in the knowledge that I am better for having known you. And I know that together we have made a difference.
As attendees mingled after the ceremony, Cameron said that the events of July 2010 set the tone for his entire tour of duty at Air Station Sitka.
The Coast Guard is always a close-knit group of people, so I think we probably would have been close anyway, but it really brought us closer to the town because, I had just arrived here. I didn't really know anybody in the town that well, and they absolutely came to our rescue and helped us with everything at every turn. It was almost overwhelming to experience something like that.
He says Sitka is a coveted duty station among Coast Guard aviators.
We make sure we get the best pilots here. We make sure every pilot that comes here is on at least their second tour. And so it's like stepping up to the big leagues when you come here. Everybody is excited to be here and to be part of that, and it kind of sets the tone of the unit.
It's a tone not lost on the new commanding officer.
I keep telling people that really I feel like I won the lottery. This is within the community that I'm in, the H-60 community. I now have the dream job, and I couldn't be happier.
Commander Ward Sandlin did a tour of duty at Air Station Kodiak and also lived in Kodiak when he was a boy, and his dad was in the Coast Guard. He served as a pilot instructor, and has worked at Coast Guard headquarters in Washington, D.C. He comes to Sitka directly from Air Station Clearwater in Florida, where he was operations officer. This is his first command.
The men and women at the air station here at Sitka are unparalleled. They're absolutely some of the best we have, and I'm looking forward to working with them. I'm so excited to be working with the people in town. I've heard nothing but great things about the support that we get from the town of Sitka.
As for Commander Cameron, he's off to Virginia and is due to become Captain Cameron soon. He'll serve as Chief of Incident Management for a region stretching from New Jersey to North Carolina. Cameron said he'll be in town for a few more weeks to let his kids finish out the school year. Sandlin, meanwhile, says his wife and his daughter and son arrived earlier this week, and that he's looking forward to transitioning into Sitka life. He also adds that you might have seen him around town already, breaking in his new pair of extra tufts. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the Pebble Partnership, developing a comprehensive mine plan that meets Alaska's regulatory requirements while supporting sustainable fisheries in Southwest Alaska. PebblePartnership.com. Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Heather Arono. This week on AK, climate change. Alaska natives living in some Arctic coastal communities became the nation's first climate change refugees when the loss of protective ice exposed them to huge waves and storm surges, making it too dangerous to remain in their homes. But inland villages are also feeling the effects of global warming. Melting permafrost is devastating the Delta community of Selawik. To find out how residents are coping, Johanna Urich visited the village where the land is sinking and eroding.
Looking down from the plain on a bright April day, Selawik glows under white snow. On the ground, people buzz by on snow machines. Some are ice fishing on the river and nearby lakes. In the village, evidence of melting permafrost is everywhere. Houses have cracks in windows and walls. Doors don't close. And the above-ground Arctic pipes carrying water and sewer are far from level as they thread through town. Selawik, which once stood on firm, mostly frozen ground, is now sinking and eroding.
What makes Selawik different is that it's a delta community, and the effects of warming permafrost are being seen in the infrastructure across the whole community.
Michael Brubaker studied Selawik for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. The freeze-thaw cycles that now dominate Selawik became a problem when the sinking ground opened leaks in the connections of the water and sewer utility lines, allowing cold into the insulated above-ground pipes. This winter's extreme cold temperatures froze the village water system, prompting the governor to declare a state of emergency. That was December 28th. Raven Sheldon, member of the Selawik City Council.
Folks here, yesterday was a big day for them because their water and sewer finally went through. It just went through and everybody was doing laundry, cleaning, and they were so happy.
Water and sewer costs $180 a month. The bill comes even when villagers have to cut ice from the river and boil it for water and use honey buckets. Today, men in yellow sanitation gear go from house to house gathering plastic bags of human manure. To keep the lines from freezing, villagers pay huge electric bills to operate heat tape wrapped around pipes running from junction boxes to their homes. Resident Lewis Skin.
This year, our electric bill went high as $1,600 a month just so that we can get that heat tape going to keep our water from freezing. You know, I just paid part of it because I can't afford that kind of bill.
Jack Snyder wrapped the utility connection with a caribou skin.
That caribou worked better than insulation, glass type insulation.
In April, city crews were thawing pipes to the last few homes. But City Councilman Raven Sheldon was worried. They need money to fix the problems.
I don't see in the next few years any kind of relief until we find money to address those issues. We're going to continue to struggle.
Houses need to be re-leveled annually. Some need to be moved from the eroding river's edge. Many wonder how long the two bridges connecting the village will stand, with the ground sinking and being washed out from under them. Studies indicate that Selawik may be entirely underwater in 50 years. The surrounding land and water which people rely on for food is changing. With only a quarter of the town's population holding down jobs, hunting, gathering, and fishing puts food on the table. The changes on the land are dramatic. One thermokarst upstream of Selawik, created by melting permafrost, looks like a giant crater on the side of the hill measuring as large as a football field. Disappearing permafrost causes erosion on riverbanks, making them wider, shallower, more silty, and raising concerns about habitat for the whitefish, pike, and shefish villagers rely on to feed their families. Some, like Elder Bert Griss, want to move Selawik to the mountains 17 miles away.
Beautiful. Beautiful up there. And there's gravel. That's the solution. The question is, can we come up with funding to do that? We could deal with the problem here at Selawik to some degree. We still can. Question is, how long can we do it?
Others, like Tommy Ballett, an elder with a Friends Church, are not budging. With a deep belief in God, he takes a fatalistic attitude towards attempts to deal with climate change.
I wouldn't move. This is where I was born. This is where I'm going to die. I don't care if the rest of Selawik is under the water. As long as my house is on top, that's where I'm going to stay. Whatever happens in our world is going to happen. And if Selawik sinks under, then we're going to do it. I also believe that we can't prevent it. Actually, I think everybody's wasting money.
Ballett turns away at the thought of a price tag no one can even imagine. And the prospect of giving up a way of life in a place where you can step out your door and catch fish all year round. That and the abundant waterfowl and migrating caribou made Selawik an Inupiat paradise until the ice in the ground began melting. I'm Johanna Urich.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week we're featuring Nenana, the interior village that's home to the famous Ice Classic Lottery. The community is located where the Nenana and Tanana rivers meet.
My name is Robin Campbell. I'm the tribal administrator for Nenana Native Council. I'm also on the city council, seat A. This is my third term. We are in the interior of Alaska. We are 54 miles south of Fairbanks. The Ice Classic is the only thing it's pretty known for, and we've been working on that. We're updating our community plan as we speak. The other thing that I think Nenana is known for probably is the cultural activities that we have here, like our traditional potlatches and ceremonies. We're opening our brand new transfer site on Friday, which is really exciting because we haven't had a place to dump garbage in probably 15 years. We have to go all the way to Fairbanks, which is 55 miles north, and to Clear, 33 miles south. So that's really exciting for us. We're starting a new fish camp this summer with the help of the ANA grant and the Yukon Fisheries. They got a grant for us to do a two-year fish camp for families to learn and prepare fish, traditional fish cutting, and have some mentoring and cultural activities there. It's a good place to raise kids and just chill, you know. Nice place to live.
Robin Campbell is tribal administrator in Nenana. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK on Alaska News Nightly. We had help this week from Johanna Urich, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Heather Arona.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Casey Kelly in Juneau, Angela Denning Barnes and Mark Earhart in Bethel, and Ed Ronco in Sitka. Heather Arona was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline for 35 years. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission. Home, it's where you lay your head, eat home-cooked meals, and gather with friends. Home is where you grew up and learned about life. Alaska is home, and when you choose to violate someone by committing sexual assault, you harm them, and you harm yourself, your friends, your family, your home, and Alaska. No one deserves to be sexually assaulted, so make the right choice. Real Alaskans choose respect. This message brought to you by the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.